The guy reached for my weapon, and I let go of it, and I had my thumb in the trigger guard, and I threw it at the ground, and it bounced and lay across my shoes, and I stood there at attention. And the little lieutenant looked up at me, and he said, "That's all right, sailor." He said, "That's my fault." I said, "Yes, sir, I know it." And the sergeant was going out of his mind. Anyway, he picked it up, and he looked at it, and he said, "There's a little bit of dirt in the chamber here." And I said, "I'm not surprised." That poor sergeant just didn't know what to do. But anyway, when we came back, I was out there with my green uniform on, and I had one hash strap, which meant 4 years. And I didn't have another thing on the uniform. No. And after the inspection was over, he came in front of me and he said, "You got 4 years and you got something you ought to have on your chest." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Next Saturday, have it there." I said, "Yes, sir." And when I was on Liberty that weekend, I went into the Army-Navy store and bought all the ribbons and the jump wings and the whole thing. So I had my combat infantry brass, my jump wings on, I had all the ribbons, and right in the middle I had the good conduct ribbon for it. I got that. And anyway, over here I had a blue ribbon for presidential citation, and over here, this is wrong, but I had a 5th Ranger patch. And I fell out the next Saturday for inspection. And he looked, and he looked, and he looked. And after inspection, he came up to me and he says, "You got all those?" And I said, "You got my service record, look it up." That was the end of that. And then the next Saturday I came out, I had a bare chest again.
So
all the stuff was in my footlocker.
Even though you were essentially starting over in a different branch of the service, you were allowed to wear the decorations from your previous campaigns?
Oh, yeah.
Except for the patch.
Right.
Except for the Ranger patch.
And the Ranger patch on an Army uniform would have been correct.
Oh.
No, you show you. What do you do? You wear the unit you're in now. I'm in the 82nd Airborne right now. I wear an 82nd patch right here. On the other side, this is where I was. No. And you wear the Ranger patch over there. But not on a Marine uniform. You don't put Army stuff on a Marine uniform.
Was there
Army stuff with CIB, Combat Infantry Badge, that's Army. Jump wings, that's Army. Yeah. Now, I see this guy who just got in trouble being a Marine and said something about queers that, everybody's, he wears jump wings. Well, okay, Marines do go through jump school in Fort Benning, and they get jump wings, and they're allowed to wear them.
What do you... Communism was a pretty hot topic. Communism was a pretty hot topic for many years prior to you going in. Mm-hmm. And what did you feel about the communist threat in the country, and what were the other soldiers talking about? What was that?
They were easy to ignore. No, big deal.
You didn't feel it was a threat?
All it was is a chance for the press to make a headline. Nothing more. And I didn't read papers in those days. I ignored them. And we didn't have television. No. Big deal. So they told me about McCarthy, and I thought, all right. And I found out that Bobby Kennedy was the number one on the McCarthy committee. And I thought, well, all right. Who were the other guys here? Two other guys on the McCarthy committee. Whatever.
And even in the 40s, you felt the same way?
Yeah.
Throughout the 50s.
And who's the lady that's the woman's liver?
Oh. Gloria Steinem?
She was on that committee.
Was she?
Yeah. She was a member of the McCarthy committee. She worked for them. Yes. I mean, the press doesn't tell you that nowadays. They don't tell you, well, Bobby Kennedy was a leading member of it. They don't want to hurt Bobby Kennedy. They don't mind hurting everybody else.
So going to Korea, you're going to Korea with that mindset. Mm-hmm. It was military duty.
Well, what it was, we were going to Korea because the North Koreans had invaded South Korea, and we were going to throw them the hell out. And then, after a while, MacArthur went nuts and chased them all the way back to the Yalu River, and then the Chinese came in and chased him back. And then I got in there.
Talk some about the events leading up to March 13th.
March 13th? Oh, boy. Well, all right. It was normal for a corpsman to be assigned to a platoon, to be the medic for a platoon for a given amount of time. Now, it depended on the flow of people coming through, the amount of time, you know. And after a certain amount of time, you rotated out. You went from being in a platoon on the line to being at the company headquarters at the medical station, down to the battalion medic station, and then finally to the hospital, to the Navy hospital, and then home. And that was your year. It took me a year to go, pardon me, do all those steps. And I had taken the first step. I was going from a line company, but instead of moving me to company headquarters, they moved me over to support company. Now, support company in every battalion was where all the big weapons were. But on the hill in Korea, the big weapons were spread all over the place. Like the company I was in, that I left, we had one of their 50 caliber machine guns up at the front of ours, you know. They were all over the place. So they were sending me to a platoon, or to a company, to a platoon really, but to a company that was just spread all over. There's no way. And I was off on a bunker on the reverse slope down, and it's all beat up. Some mortar round that caved the roof in. And for 2 days I was there, you know. But I was close to that place where we had our hot meal once a day. And I'd time it so I would be there at the same time my old buddies were, my old platoon, my old corpsman. And the way that tent was where we ate, they had two boards going between the posts that held the tent up, you know, and then we'd stand there and we'd put our mess kit down, we'd eat. And I'd meet with my buddies and confab back and forth. And they told me, boy, we got one going tomorrow. Yeah, what are you going to do? They told me all about it. We're going down and we're going to wipe out those two gook mortars that are giving us a fit all the time. We didn't even know there were two. We didn't know one or two, but we thought the common word was that there was a pair of them, you know. And I said, oh, for pity's sake. And the little guy who had replaced me, brand new, 2 days into Korea, was standing over there, you know. And I could just tell by looking at him, he wasn't too eager. He didn't think that was a good idea to go on that patrol right away. So I looked at him and said, well, why don't we trade? You come over and take my support company platoon for that day, and I'll go down and run the patrol for you. Oh, yeah. I said, well, let's find our lieutenants and see if we can get permission. So we went out, and we did. We got permission. And I stole a single apple, and I brought it back to that bunker that I was sleeping in, and I made arrangements to have somebody wake me up about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and so I could go get ready. And I did, and I packed up. I got everything I was supposed to have. I had my first aid kit. I had my rifle. I had a nylon stretcher all rolled up and hung on my belt. I had a big hunk of rope all rolled up and held on my belt. And I was ready for the patrol, and I wandered over to my old platoon. Just a couple of hundred yards, no big deal. And I got in line, and I found out that my platoon leader, Carl Appleby, who's now out in Escondido, California, was not going, that they had sent along an officer from battalion headquarters to lead the patrol. And I said, okay, so Mr. Appleby and I were talking and we were getting started. And we had with us an observer for the Army Artillery, big guns, monstrous guns are going to come. And we had an observer from the Marine Artillery, smaller guns. We're going to get them. And we had an observer from the Navy. We can see the boats out over here, and they're going to shoot them. And there's a guy from the Air Force. They're going to bring airplanes in for two mortars. If you can believe I was good. And I looked at Appleby, and he gave me that. So we took off. And to go get down the hill, you go down to the point where our point bunker is, and your point bunker you run into. And
yes, the book.
I described it completely there.
Oh,
you know what that's like. And to get from the point bunker down, you got to go down a hill like this on a rope. So the barbed wire is right up the top of the hill. And then you get on a rope, and then there's a big old saddle that smooths out, and then it falls off again. So there we are. We go down the trench, dark, middle of the night, as far as I'm concerned. And we go. And the way the patrol is set up, we got a squad leading it. And then all the observers and stuff, you know, sergeants and officers and all that kind of crap. And I'm right in the middle of them. And then a squad at the end of it. And way up at the front, of course, is the guy from battalion headquarters that's leading us. And we're going down the hill, and it's a rough old climb. There's a lot of snow. Because the south is that way, and we're in the north face, so the snow isn't melted off yet. On the one we're looking at, it's starting to melt off. But we're on our way down, and we get all the way down to where, when we get up to the edge and look over the edge, and then the edge falls away just like that. Forget that. We're not going there. But that's where the mortars are, down over there. And we're going to take all our people, the observers, and put them along the edge. And they got their radios, and they got their radio operators, and they can give their instructions, and they all got their maps. And we set the Marines up in a perimeter around them, like in a big old half circle. And I'm there in the middle. Now, the lieutenant had taken this one, the downhill side, and he's put them around. And the sergeant had taken the uphill side and put them around. And in the meantime, I'm standing on this flat rock about like this, getting out of my white suit. You know, to do that, I've got to take off my belt and my first aid gear and put it on the ground. And I do, and I'm standing there. And then the sergeant comes down and tells me, he said, I got so-and-so. And the lieutenant comes up and hears that, and I said, well, I'll tell you what, as soon as I get squared away here, I'm going to go around and I'm going to find them. So when crap hits the fan, well, I won't have to search for them all over the place, I'll know where they are. And the lieutenant says, good idea, fine, you do that. And I took one step to pick up the bag, and that was it. I blew up the mine right then. And I'd been stomping all around that damn thing. And probably it was frozen up. Who knows? I don't know. I can't know. But all I know is that it was a loud noise, and it was a blackness, a complete blackness. And then I heard this voice saying words that I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, who's saying those? And it was me. I was swearing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it was me, and I stopped, you know. And I sat up, and I looked down at me, and I had one foot. The boot on the right foot was half gone. The inside was just all beat up. But there wasn't any left foot. No. And I looked past that left foot, and some Marines were down in the shrubbery down there, and they were pulling a body out. And I said, good Lord, did one go off down there too? And he said, nah, that's a sergeant. He was up there with you. It blew him right off the hill.
He survived, though.
Oh, they got him. They got him up to me. And the lieutenant was lying down here, and I was lying down here. And we collected a crowd. All the guys that were observers were down there now with us. The guys on the outside edge stayed there and protected. You know, we had them working, and I got them working, and I found out that both the other guys, the lieutenant and the sergeant, both had both legs broken. Right at the boot top. So I said, all right, now what you do, collect overcoats all over the place and put their feet there as if they were normal, you know, and wrap them up tight in that overcoat. So you want to cast them that way, but you also give for warmth. And they did all that, and then we took the sergeant because he was the smallest, and we put him in that stretcher that I had. You know, they got two sticks to go down the side of the stretcher. And they took a rope and wound it around so he couldn't, and then they started him up the hill, you know. But they couldn't do that with the lieutenant and me because there weren't any more stretchers. So we're laying there in the snow. In the meantime, somebody has called up to the top of the hill. And the top of the hill heard the mine go, you know, and they knew something was going on. And they immediately put together another platoon and some more corpsmen. And they were starting down the hill. Now, it took them a while to get there, too, about an hour to get down there. And when they got there, some of the guys in that picture of a corpsman were in the group. But they put the two of us in stretchers and tied us in. And what I had them do to me, what I had the first gang do to me, was to take my foot. I thought the foot was gone, but it was sitting there dangling by the tendon, you know, swinging around. And I said, oh, put the foot up where it would be. And then I said, wrap it up inside an overcoat. And they did. And then better than that, I had, in my first aid kit, I had little ampules of morphine. They looked like toothpaste tubes. You know, you pull the cap off and there's a needle and you put the needle in the muscle and you squeeze the tube and it's a one dose of morphine. And I made sure that we all had one of those, and I took one of the sergeants that was, you know what I ought to do, I'll get it later. One of the sergeants that was an observer, and I made him do it to me first so that he would know. I said, okay, now what you do? And I put it in his hand. I said, hit me right here in the muscle. Make sure you get the muscle. And then I said, squeeze it and throw it away. Don't let anybody get anywhere near it. Just throw it away. Get rid of it. Now I said, go get those guys. And he did. And anyway, there we were. The lieutenant and I are all that's left. The others are gone up the hill. And we're on morphine. And when they come down, they start us up the hill, and they're carrying us up the hill. And I know on my stretcher, I've got Frank Dedeman, one of the corpsmen, you know, and some other guys from my old platoon that knew me, you know. I had been their corpsman. And one of them knew that my favorite weapon of all time was a slingshot. And my slingshot I had made using rubber from an IV tube, you know, and I got a little piece of leather, no problem getting, you know, from a boot or something. And what I was shooting at, 45 slugs. I was taking 45 slugs out of the bullet, throwing the bullet away, and just keeping the slugs. I had a whole stocking full of 45 slugs down here in my field jacket pocket. And I had the slingshot around my neck and hanging down here. And one of the guys remembered, you know, and said, hey, you got that old slingshot? And I said, yeah, I got it. He said, can I have it? I said, certainly, you know. So I fished around with all the junk on me then where I had trouble, but we got it out, and I reached down in my pocket, and I handed him the slug. He said, thank you. Later on, I heard that he was having a ball with it. But I could shoot a 45 slug better with a slingshot than I could with a pistol. I was not much with a pistol. Want me to hit the side of a hill? Yeah, I'll get it. No problem. I have bang. I get the side of a hill. But I would shoot at a crow with that pistol, and that crow would never save her. Dang, dang. I was terrible with the pistol. But anyway, we got up the hill, and we got up to that place where the hill went like this up to the point, and they weren't going to get us in those stretchers up that hill because to get yourself up, you have to use both hands on a rope, you know. And we're sitting there, and the lieutenant that is leading the gang down to us is a guy that what I was in St. Thomas with. He was a cross-country runner, and when he got out of the Marines at the end of World War II, why, he stayed in the Marine Reserve. And then when he graduated from St. Thomas, where they gave him a commission, and took him back and sent him through officers' candidate school. But Tom Powers, not Tom, last name is Powers, whatever it is, Powers, Jim, Joe, something Powers, was in charge of getting us back up the hill. And he got us up to that flat spot before it went like this, and we weren't going to get us up there, and the helicopter pilots were not going to come in the front slope. They wouldn't. So he went up and got the helicopter pilots back on the back slope and walked them up. Said, there they are. How do we get them out of here? And the helicopter pilots said, well, all right. He didn't want to, but he said, okay. And there were he had a buddy with him. There were two of them in the cab. And he says, well, we'll go back and we'll get it. We'll come up. But first of all, you get us a landing place right down there about where they are. And you have all those Marines ready to get them aboard, and we're going to get out of there right away. You know? So, okay, they came back down, and they pounded a bunch of snow flat, and to make it a little strong, they put rocks in it, and they put some old 40, you know, shell casings in it. You know what I mean? And after a while, that helicopter came up, and boom, over the top, and he came down. And I swear, now, I could be wrong. I don't know this either. But I don't think he put the runners on the snow. I think he held it up there about this far off. I'm not sure. But they threw the lieutenant on the far side and threw that cover over the top of him, you know. And they threw me on the near side under the pilot, and they put the cover on, and the cover wouldn't latch. My stretcher was such that it was up there, and it wouldn't let it come to the latch. And they forced her on, and finally some Marine just took the plastic thing and put it on the deck and used the butt of his rifle and bam, and took the whole plastic out of the front of it. And he put that on. Now, that was a way of locking me in, but it wasn't a way of keeping the air. You know, it was cold. But anyway, they locked it on, and then the guy flew. And I'm sitting there, I'm lying like this, and I'm looking up, and I can see a little bit in both directions. And I can see the pilot, of course. There he is right above me. And he had got a drop of blood in his head. He is absolutely white blood. And we're going, and I can see some trees, and all of a sudden the trees are going like this, and then boom, up they come again. So what he had done, he's gotten up and gotten over into a hollow and dropped down into it. And pretty soon he's going up, and he's going up, and all the blood comes back in his head. And I know immediately that we're over the crest. We're on the back, you know. And he looks at me, and he sees me looking up at him, and he gives me this kind of a thing. So I knew we were all right. And boy, we just lit up. We didn't horse around at all. And we lit out for the aid station way down the bottom of the hill, way far away, who knew by radio we were coming. You know, they were expecting us. They expected us an hour ago. And we got down there, and we lit in back of the emergency station. And a bunch of crewmen came running out of the emergency station to grab our two stretchers, and one of the guys that grabbed mine was a guy I knew, you know, but he didn't recognize me, so it didn't matter. So they put us in the emergency tent on a couple of sawhorses that were up at a height there. They put the stretcher down on it, and we were high enough that the doctor could, you know, didn't have to bend over to work on us. We were up there for him. And all I remember is when they came to me, they had a big thing that looked like a hedge trimmer. But what it was, it would cut clothes, and it would go down, boom, boom, boom. And that overcoat that was down there around my foot had gone. And the minute it was gone, there was my foot. And the doctor came back to me, and he said, well, I might have to take that off. And I said, well, yes, sir, I expect so. And he looked up over my shoulder, just shook his head yes, and the guy, whoever was there, put a cup over my nose and said, count from 100 backwards. And then he poured ether in the cup. I made it all the way to 97. We're gone. And the next time I came to, I was in a room, dark. There was a corpsman sitting on either side of me. There was a big screen across me right here, so I couldn't see past. But I sat up, I moved my head one night, and the corpsman noticed it. I said, wait, can we do something for you? Are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm all right. And immediately got sick to my stomach. Now, the only thing I'd had to eat all day long was that one apple. And I barfed a whole pailful. I don't know where it all came from, but there it was. And then I put my head back down, and I said, could you wipe my foot, please. And I said, I got flies crawling all over that damn thing. And he said, sure, which foot? And I said, the left one. Of course, it was gone. And I went to sleep. And when I woke up the next time, I was no longer at this place. You know, now, I say a dark room, but there was a, what you call lantern up there, one of the kerosene table, Coleman lantern hanging there. And it was making light. But anyway, when I woke up the next time, I was out in the ward, and it was daylight. And I put my head up, and I looked, and there was a guy sitting in the bed next to me. He was a Navy chief. He was an Indian. And Indians in the Navy get the nickname chief. So he was a chief. And he had been my teacher at Corps School. And he looked over and he said, I didn't think you were ever going to wake up. I said, oh. So we're sitting there, and he's asking me what the hill's like. Now, a chief doesn't get up to where I was, you know. So I'm telling him all about it. And a nurse walking by sees that I'm alert and awake. And she comes over and she says, are you hungry? And I said, I think so. And she sent out and she got, well, they had a special dinner for guys like me just out of surgery, you know, and it's all liquid. There was some soup and there was some, you know, warm drinks and one thing and another. And she sat on the head of my bed and put my head on her lap and then fed me the soup a little at a time, and I never had it so good. Good Lord Almighty, there I was with sheets around my body. I hadn't had a sheet around my body in months, you know. And a pretty girl feeding me soup, and the chief is getting a big kick out of it all. Anyway, she finishes and puts my head back in the pillow, and then she said, I'll see you later, and I go to sleep, I'm gone again. And it's like that for, I don't know how long, I can't tell you how long, but I wake up, they feed me, they put me to sleep, and but I woke up once and I heard trucks going like mad. And I said, what the hell's going on? And they said, they're moving the whole Marine Division over to the West Coast to be above Seoul. I said, holy cats, they're going to take us too? He said, no. They're going to come and get you and put you on a plane and take you down to Busan and put you on a hospital ship. And it wasn't long. They came in with a stretcher and took me off the bed I was on, cot really. A bed I was on, and put me in an ambulance and took me to a field, and there was a C-47 there, and room for stretchers, and was sitting with walking wounded, and they flew us down to Busan and landed, and we got off the C-47 and they put us on some more school bus type things, and there I was sitting right behind the driver at the edge of the window and looking out, and one thing another, and we're going down a road, and it's full of potholes, you know, not the most comfortable ride in the world. And we come to a railroad track, and we stop, and then we turn down a railroad track, and my mind is going, my God, now we're going to have ties all the way, boom, 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 all the way. And the guy steps the bus, and he gets out, and he cranks down a set of railroad wheels, and cranks up the road wheels, and away we go, as smooth a ride as you can imagine, right down on the pier. And right next to us, where the daggone bus stops, is this great big white ship, the hospital ship Haven. Now, the Haven is for all those guys that didn't want to go in the FMF when we were at Bremerton. That's where they're working. And I'm sitting there in the window watching them go by, you know, hey, I call a couple of names. And they come over, Herder, and they shout up, Herder's here, you know, kind of thing. And the first thing you know, man, I'm off that bus, and they got me on a sling, and I'm up, and they lift me up, and they put me down in the orthopedic ward. And then they've got to go to work. They got to unload everybody. But eventually, all the guys that were in Bremerton are sitting in the orthopedic ward, and I'm on a bottom bunk in a nice, big pillows, and comfortable. And they're picking my brain about what's Korea like, you know, what's it like up there on the mountain. And we're telling stories. And there's this guy standing over by the door. He got a foot on a bunk and his arms straight. And he's wearing the uniform. They could have been a chief in the Navy. You know, khaki shirt, khaki pants, one thing. Well, it turned out he wasn't. He was a doctor. He was the doctor in charge of the orthopedic ward. And he was sitting there and listening and getting the whole thing and enjoying it. And finally he said, "Hey, you guys, get out of here. Let this guy get some rest." And they, "Yes, sir, yes, sir." And they all jump. And he comes over and he stands over me. He says, "Do you want beer or brandy with your meals?" Because he looked at me, he said, "I must have lost some weight. I was down to 180 again, if you can imagine it." And I looked at him, I said, "Yes, sir." And that's what I got. I got beer and brandy with my meal. Every meal I got a little old brandy and a glass of beer. And we went over to Yokohama, the hospital. What they did on my legs, they put a cast on this foot. There were broken bones in the foot. They put a cast, and then they wrapped it all up. And on this one, they just guillotined it. They just cut it off, and then they put some strapping and glued it to the skin and pulled it down so it was over the top and pulled it in. And then they had a wire basket off a cast, my cast fixed to my calf, the wire basket down like this, right? And with elastic, they pulled that whole skin down, you know, and locked it up. And they had to change that dressing from time to time, which meant that into surgery and take everything off and put everything on. And well, now I didn't have to take either anymore. From then on out, it was all spinals. You know, there was no problem with that. And they had to do it once on the hospital ship, and then once again when they got to Yokohama, they did it again. Oh, Yokohama! I could not stand those things we had to use to defecate. Those pans, you know, it drove me nuts. And I did everything I could to miss those. And it turned out that in the Oklahoma hospital in the orthopedic ward, there were trapezes and handholds and things all over the place. And I got them to let me go to the bathroom the normal way, which meant that I transferred myself from the wheelchair over, and all I had to do was take an arm off the wheelchair. And I'd do that, and then I'd be coming back, and all myself. I didn't even need a corpsman to get there or get back. And I was coming back this one time, and they had linoleum floors, and I was going a little fast, maybe a little faster than I should have, not very, but yeah. And I came to my bed, and I put a stop, and the wheel skidded, and the chair tipped forward, and it was one of those big old chairs with the cane back, you know, and the legs were out already for my legs, you know. And down I went, and I slid right on off, pillows and all, just slid off and slid down the floor. And, of course, the nurse down there at the nearest bed, in the corner, and they're all running. Here I am lying in the middle of the floor. I'm comfortable. No pain, no strain, no nothing. I think it's funny. I'm laughing. So they come, and they struggle, and they get me back onto a big old gurney, you know, and one thing and another, and over to bed and into bed. And the nurse is chiding me, "Don't you ever do anything that foolish again." I didn't watch my speed from then on out. But anyway, they decided, okay, we're going to fly these guys home. There's nothing more we can do to them here. Whatever they do to them now, they got to do back stateside. So they're going to put us on an airplane and fly us. And the same nurse, you still saw the picture of her, she, on that wire screen that's out there where my foot would have been, she puts a great big red bow on it, you know. And there I go. I go on a stretcher, and they take me, and they put me in a Cadillac-type ambulance. My God, tall, tall class. And we get down to the airport, and the ambulance backs up onto the plane. He goes up there, and then all the people, they're all Air Force types now. I call them corpsmen, but they're Air Force types, they're not Navy anymore. They come in and they grab my stretcher, and they put me, and I'm on the fifth one up. You know, the bottom one is right about that far off the floor, but I'm the fifth one up, and there's rows of us. And the plane is full of Army, Navy, and Marine type patients, you know. But I'm way up at the top one. And they get it all loaded up, and they get everything secured and everything, and then we start flying. You know, we take off. It's comfortable. There's nothing to it. I'm just sitting there, just enjoying myself. And about halfway someplace, I don't know, halfway anywhere, the pilot on a speaker system says, we're flying over Midway Island. We're almost there. We'll be in Hawaii, you know, at a certain time. And so I go, okay, fine. And I go to sleep. When I wake up, my stretcher is splitting, and I'm starting to come through it. And the guy underneath me is a guy without any legs at all. He got them both off above the knee, both short, one very short. And I'm coming down, and we immediately call a nurse over. They look at it and say, oh, my God. And she comes and gets a whole bunch of corpsman types. And they get my stretcher down, and they said, okay, now you lock your elbows on the sides of the stretcher and don't let it fall through, you know. So I did, and they got me on a floor, and then they switched me over to a new stretcher and then put it back up there. And it turned out the guy underneath me is Bob Ellington. And he and I were great friends, and he was a Marine, and he was the way he was because a grenade went off above his knees. You know, and he was pretty well beat up. But anyway, we landed in Air Force Base at Sacramento. I saw the name of it on the paper the other day, but I've forgotten again. And we landed at an Air Force Base in Sacramento, and right back into Cadillacs again. You know, two guys per Cadillac, and a boy down the freeway would go to Oakland. You know, this. And we get into Oakland, and by the time we get there, the corpsmen, now it's all Navy corpsmen again, the corpsmen get us into beds and comfortable, and the nurses give us a sleeping something or other, and we go to sleep. And when I woke up, my bed was surrounded, and there were three or four nurses and two doctors and some corpsmen all surrounding my bed, all in whites, you know. And I'm looking, they're looking at me, and the one doctor's got my chart, and he's looking at the chart, and he's got the x-rays, and he's looking at. And I don't say a thing. I just sit there and watch him. And the doctor gives orders. Okay, next we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that, and take care of him like this, and all the medication, and make sure that everything's okay. And then they start walking across the aisle to another guy that came in with me. He's just over there on the other side of the ward. There's 40-some of us, 42 of us, in this one ward. All of us lost a limb. And there's two wards like that, you know. And anyway, they're over there, and as they walk over, the guy in the next bed to me here, who's an old-timer, you know, and he says, see that nurse? He says, watch her walk. And I say, oh, boy, that lady got something. He says, yeah, she's got a wooden leg. And it turns out that while she was in the Navy down in Cuba, she was climbing on a mountain, and broke her leg, and they put a cast in. It was too tight, and she tried to tell them it was too tight. They had another nurse, and they ignored her, and they eventually had to amputate her. But they put her in charge of the clinic where we learned to walk. Now, she was our walking coach. And anyway, that she was there watching, and she was one of the new patients. And so the next time I went to surgery was about 2 days later, and they changed dressings again, and then they got a look at what they had to work with, took new x-rays, the whole thing. And then the next time after that I went in, why, they closed me up. They did a call a revision. Boy, you talk about a thing that leaves you in pain. But anyway, they did the second time, and then when they take you out after the revision, they put you in bed, and then the nurse is watching you constantly. And she's got the Demerol, and she's ready to come out with the Demerol, and boom, put you to sleep again, get out of here. And things worked out. And eventually that healed up, and by then they've got the stump closed. You know, the thing that about the revision, that make the leg is this long. When they do the revision, it's this long. and you got a sawbone, and that's where the pain comes in. And when they do, they got to close the muscle in up over, and the skin is from flat and done all that kind of stuff.
How long a process was this, Harry? Do you remember from the time you were injured until that point?
Less than a month.
So you were back in the States within a month?
Oh, yeah. I was back in the States in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And then I had a long wait because my calves are so big, you know, I'm a tackle. So okay, I got big calves, you know, you got to have big calves to be a tackle. I had to shrink them down like mad so that they could build a leg that fit me properly. So what they did to shrink, they gave me elastic ACE bandages and I wrapped them up real tight. And then they sent me home on a 2-week leave. You know, and I wrapped them up. When I came back, I was shrunk down considerably. And they could build me a leg, and that's what they did. They built me a leg. And two of us, with a leg gone. One of them, Reed, had lost his right leg above the knee. I had lost my left leg below the knee, and Bob had both legs gone above the knee. And the three of us chipped in less than $100 and bought an old 1938 Buick, which had a stick shift. And we had 2 feet. And Bob was sitting in the middle with the gear shift he'd shipped, and I was on the outside edge. And whenever we needed it, whenever we were at a stop sign or on a hill, I'd get my foot across and I'd work the accelerator. Reed would work all the other pedals, and we'd be driving all over San Francisco with that. I mean, we were having a ball. We drove it into San Francisco one time, the three of us, and we parked it, and we got out in wheelchairs and crutches and all that kind of stuff. And we went down to Market Street, and we got all split up, never found each other again. And Sunday night, we came home, and Bob beat us. He was home for, he's a guy in a wheelchair, guy with no legs. Bob beat us, and there he was in bed, and I'm walking in, and Reed isn't there yet. And I said, how'd you get here? He said, I didn't have any trouble. He said, I just went down and got on that B Rapid Transit or whatever it is.
The BART.
BART. And I got over here, and some people put me on a bus, and I got out the hospital. I said, oh, good Lord Almighty, where's the car? Wherever we parked it. and we're talking, and then in comes Reed. You know? And where's the guy? And so Reed and I just said, well, we better go rescue that car. You know? And we take off, and we go back to San Francisco. And here are the cops just parked right outside the French Legation on a hill like that. And the cops are just starting to move it. They're just starting to tow it. And we come up there, and we're both on crutches, and we tell them the story. And, oh, well, what the heck? We'll get you guys out of here. And they did. They got us in the car, and we drove it over home. What we did, we parked it outside the main gate of the hotel on a hill. So all we had to do was lift that, get the clutch and let her roll, and we could kick into a start.
You talked about being your own best teachers and controlling hysteria.
Yeah.
And could you talk about the rehabilitation process that you and your friends experienced?
Let me go to that worst case, the absolute worst case, when I finally realized what things were. We were in the hospital, and Reed and I were at the stage where we had legs. They weren't going to make Bob legs. Bob died, didn't want them. We had our legs. We were almost through, you know, almost ready to go home. And a new load of people came in from Korea. And one of the guys had lost both legs. I can't remember AKBK, but he had lost both legs. He'd lost one arm and lost fingers off the other side and lost one eye. And he was a mess. And he was down on the other side of the nurse's station from where I was, so I didn't get a good look. And we were deliberately not collecting around his bed to make a sign out of him. But we couldn't help but hear him. And he was deliberately being upbeat about everything, you know, I'm going to be all right. Well, now, in the Philadelphia hospital is where they do eyes. In the Oakland hospital is where they do amputations. So they took him first of all and flew him on to Philadelphia to get his eyes taken care of. After his eyes are taken care of, he comes back to Oakland. But boy, then we're gone. We're gone home already. Yeah. So I don't know what happened to him. But I remember lying in my bed and thinking, this has got to be what hysteria is. You know, it can't be anything else. The guy is, that's a sad case. I don't care how you look at it. And how am I going to sit there and feel sorry for myself? Here I am, I got both knees, I got everything.
I'm just amazed, though, that you were so lucid at the time of the accident that you were able to give direction and keep your cool. I'm just amazed at that.
I'd be surprised if I wasn't.
It's remarkable. Yeah.
But anyway, that's the case. It was such, at the hospital, where there were 42 of us in all kinds of states. One guy, I remember, had both hands gone. He'd been a great tennis player, too, a great ranked high school type tennis player. And came back and stood by a bed. A guy had no legs. And he stood there and ran in place. He said, oh, this feels good. Oh, and the guy was without any legs, he said, oh yeah. Who do you feel sorry for? There isn't any of that kind of stuff. One guy, a Navy guy, who lost his hands. He worked in a laundry in a ship and lost his hands because he put them in a scalding machine. He scalded them off, you know. And when they brought him to the hospital, he had the stumps. A stump on an arm is a cinch. There's no problem with that. You know, they can do that. But he had to build him new legs. But they brought him to the hospital, and the nurses were feeding him, and they were buttoning his clothes, and, you know. And he didn't like that. He wanted, but he couldn't do anything else, you know. And then finally he went down to the loom shop, and he came back, and he had a set of hooks. And he had them on for the first time. And he sat on his bed, and he unbuttoned his shirt. And then he buttoned his shirt, you know. And then he unbuttoned his shirt, and he just practiced doing buttons, doing one button with one hook. You know, he just practiced that, and never let a nurse ever touch him again. When he went to dinner, nobody fed him. He fed himself completely. He didn't have a big lunch. He didn't have a, you know, but it was all there. It was all his. And he was from Gombeck, Minnesota. He's a Minnesota boy. But he wasn't going to have any more people doing anything for him. He was all through with that.
Did you keep in touch with the guys you met there?
Pardon?
Did you keep in touch with the guys you met in Oakland?
A whole bunch of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. For instance, Reed died about 2 winters ago. I remember I wrote his wife a nice letter. Bob is still alive out in Nevada, Colorado. Bob came from Iowa, Gonvick, just barely south of the Minnesota border. Yeah. Mm. For a while, when Bob first got out, he was a hunting guide.
Really?
And he got himself a Jeep and had that thing worked so that he could sit there and drive that Jeep with no legs, just sit there and had everything worked, and he'd take people hunting up in the mountains of Colorado. He doesn't do that anymore.
Oh, he's retired now.
And you talked about how it changed your outlook on life, the rehabilitation process, too. Did you?
Well, all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of things that you used to be able to do. You can't do them anymore. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I couldn't play football because it's illegal. You can't play football with a prosthesis. Honey.
Really?
The things I did in football.
Oh, yeah.
If I'd have played against you and missed a block, I'd have broken your legs. I'd have hit you with that wooden leg, man. It's a good thing they knew what they were doing. When they forbid me to play football with a wooden leg, they were correct. But I could coach it. And the thing I learned to do was to not coach the way I played. I did not. I would not. I would not teach kids to do the things that I was taught to do, that I knew how to do. You know? And I played football a whole lot differently. I coached it a whole lot differently than I played it. Very, very differently. And you get by, and there's a whole bunch of, you can't run any place, you know, you can't, okay, fine, I can run to where, from here to the door, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, you change. You if you don't change, you're out of it. You must. So the whole, everything you do in life changes, and you start thinking more. For instance, I've always had the brain I've got. Mm-hmm. The fact that I can do chemistry and physics, I could have done any time I wanted to. But I didn't want to when I was a little kid. You know. After a while, they'd go, okay, fine, I can do those things. And it just changed the way of looking at it. I am what I am today because of her. But
and what is she? Why do you say that? Why do you say that?
She made me be a human being. Made a gentleman out of me. Well, you know what I must have been like when I was a kid.
There was a refining process that went on.
Do what?
A refining process that went on.
Well, you talk about a refining. Indeed, a refining. Like starting putting it all back in the mixer and starting all over again.
She saw the diamond in the rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get a kick out of this. I graduated from high school. A class of approximately all numbers now are approximately 150 kids in our graduating class in Rudling. And I was ranked by grades 140th or more. Might have been 148th, I don't know. But not very much. And I didn't care. I was going in the Army. In fact, I was already in the Army. No big deal. What are you going to do? Kick me out of the Army? No. So anyway, later on, when we got up at Hayward, I wanted to go to a school to learn about computers because I didn't know a damn thing about computers. And I went over to the university, what you call it, at Rice Lake, and I had to apply for admissions, and they had to write to Red Wing, and Red Wing wrote back that I was in the top 10% of the class. Now, how I managed that is beyond me. But I have the letter. I have everything in a file in there.
They were reading the transcript upside down.
Something like that. Oh, boy. I was so shocked to find out that that's where I was. And the second shock came when a whole, my class, the 1943 class, has occasional confabs in Red Wing. And the three guys who were the top scholars in our senior class all look at me differently now. I never in high school did a day's homework. Never. I didn't believe in it. Those books are school books. They stay in school.
Why didn't you?
I didn't in college either.
Did you consider when you got out of the Army and or out of the Navy in Korea? Did you consider going into medicine?
I started in vet med.
Oh, did you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was in vet school, and then my first semester in vet school, I had a course where I was on my feet, something like 40 hours a week, and my leg was too new and I couldn't do it. I couldn't swing it, so I switched over to education. But I was in vet school. In fact, I used to work for a vet clinic out on the Highway 100 on the south side of town. King Nelson.
You mentioned something else I wanted to...
Pardon?
You mentioned something else in your writings about how you were treated as a World War II veteran and Korean veterans, how differently you were treated with in regard to Vietnam vets.
Oh, those poor guys.
Could you?
A story. We, Bob and Reed and I, were Korean vets. They were both Marines. I was a Navy. We would take our car and we would go down to the wharf pier down in Alameda. And they had down there the Jack London Bar, for one thing. But they had down there a boat that they made a restaurant out of. A great high-class restaurant. And Bob and Reed and I would go down there. We'd make sure we had enough money to buy the meal we wanted and to pay the tip. And then we would go there and we would park the car. And Bob and Reed and I would go up, and then the waiters would come out and carry Bob in a wheelchair and carry him up, carry him down the deck to the dining room. And we would go there, and we would drink all night long and never pay for a thing. The waiter would come over with our drink. They knew what we wanted, so they just brought it. And then he'd nod over that way, and some guy didn't. We would hold the glasses up to thank him. We'd have a bottle of wine at dinner. And oh, yeah. The people treated us great. For instance, they had a thing down in Santa Barbara where a parade and, you know, all that kind of crap. And they, Eisenhower and Nixon were running. Okay, and we went down there, and they came by the hospital, and they said, would some of you guys want to go down to this thing? And they found about 20 of us that wanted to, so they put us in a plane, and they flew us down to Santa Barbara, and we were down there, and we had a special seat right by the guys that were running the show, you know. And afterwards, we all went to a hotel. They put us in a hotel in Santa Barbara, that classy swimming pool, cabanas, the whole thing, you know, lots of good things. And after the parade, we went over there, and Bob and Reed and I were sitting at this big round table, not many, but it wasn't long before little girls collected around us. And pretty soon we had a whole table full, and we were having fun, and we were telling stories. And Reed was the you think I'm a storyteller? Oh, Reed would drive you right out of your mind. Never, hardly ever tell the truth. he invented a story, and Bob would just play along nicely, you know. But anyway, we would sit there and we would have a ball, and the waiters would come by with, oh, there's our cat. Oh, that's our neighbor's cat. That's his name, by the way, Pussy.
Clever.
I expect Bill would come by after a while following it. We were sitting just having a ball with these girls, and the waiters would come by with drinks, and we were never short of drinks. It's always on the table. And finally, Mrs. Nixon came by with the two Nixon daughters, and they were both young yet, you know. And they sat, and they joined us, and they're fighting, and Reed was going in. And in the meantime, I got my Ogopogo button on, you know. He's also running for president, you know, but it's I like Ike and I go pogo kind of thing, you know? And I'm trying to talk her into voting for pogo. And she goes along with the joke. She does it nicely. And the daughters are having fun because you got all the girls her age around there, you know. And we spend the whole time trying to talk Mrs. Nixon into voting for pogo.
Did you ever meet Eisenhower?
Pardon?
Did you meet Eisenhower then? Or
never
no?
Saw him. Saw Bradley, saw Patton a couple times.
Mm-hmm. This whole Eisenhower period, the man in the blue flannel suit, what did you think about the 1950s in that period, the boom period? What did you see?
Nothing. I ignored it. I was too busy doing my thing.
Did you notice the boom, this big economic
prosperity
and building, and
I was getting army pay, $75 a month. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any boom. no big deal. I was getting $75 a month because $50 of it was jump pay, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was making more than most soldiers.
For yourself, but did you notice changes in where you were living and
I lived in a barracks.
When did you get out of the... When were you discharged out of the Navy, though?
Out of the Navy? Oh, boy. Wait a minute. Let me think. 53? Yeah, and I started school right away.
Okay. And when did you finish school?
Oh, 3 years. 3 years,
okay.
56, because I went to summer school. Mm. Yeah, I started on the St. Paul campus. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I graduated, I was still living on the St. Paul campus. It's just that it...
You know, before we forget, too, you had a... We're going to go back a little bit.
Yeah, we should get some of the information about the artifacts that you've shown us.
It was this one.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the...
Dollar bill?
Dollar bill.
Oh, you want to take that and copy it or do something
can
with it?
Can we do that?
Could do.
That would be great.
In fact, you can take this whole box and throw it in.
Oh, well,
we want to talk about it first.
We want to talk about,
Oh, you want to talk about that?
Tell us the story.
Let's see if I can read any part of it. I don't know whether I can or not.
First, tell us what this is that you're looking at here.
Okay. Tim Daly's name is on the back of it. Tommy Adkins is on the back of it. Here's Smokey Stover. And an olive, I got his picture in there.
What is it written on? It's written on a dollar bill. I'm trying to get this on tape.
What?
It's written on a dollar bill, and it's a 1935, did we say?
1935 dollar bill.
Is it?
Yes.
I don't know.
And you've used it as a diary.
Yeah. Here. The opening line, left New York. And I expect the date will be there. I don't know. I stopped somewhere. I didn't get the whole thing.
There's not a lot of room on there, is there?
Yeah. Why did you decide to do that? On a dollar bill.
I had to do something.
And then you kept this the whole time?
Yeah. And you weren't supposed to have...
It's been in that... Where's the book for? The Ranger book.
It's over there somewhere, I think.
Mm-hmm. Here, this one. Mm-hmm. It's been in that one the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And you weren't supposed to have American money, right? In World War II?
Uh-uh. I didn't want it to.
But you kept this dollar bill.
Yep. Souvenir.
And what did your daughters think about some of the things that you saved?
I don't think they've seen them all.
Did they see this? The dollar bill?
No. No, I don't think so.
You never talked about that?
No.
How come?
I don't know. So many other things you get. Good Lord.
Did they ask questions about
your
experience during the war?
Mm-hmm. Well, then it's a good thing we're interviewing you.
What?
It's a good thing we're interviewing you.
Even Ann doesn't ask me a whole bunch of those questions.
Can you talk a little bit about this and tell us what it is?
I can't tell you a thing about it except for I got it from one of the prisoners of Buchenwald.
And what is it?
That's the money they had. They had a little exchange system working inside the camp. Oh. And they could work, for instance, Reichsmark 2. They could get 2 Reichsmark for working all day long. You know, something like that.
Hmm. Were all of
I don't understand those words at all.
Do we know if all of the prisoners were eligible to get this pay or not?
Do what?
Were all of the prisoners eligible for this pay or not?
They all what?
Were all of the prisoners eligible to get paid like this?
That I don't know. I couldn't tell you a thing. I don't know.
Why did he give it to you? Do you know?
I don't know. What else? What are they going to do with it? Nothing the Germans are going to do for him anymore.
Did he trade you for something? Cigarettes or something?
I don't know why. I put it in my wallet and forgot about it. I would be glad to hear one of the prisoners tell me about it, so I would know what it was. What else you got over there that's worth a hoot?
Did you...
Miesbach.
What's it? Is that this?
Yeah. The bottom of that. It's on the bottom. Yeah.
It's a brew house.
Where we used to go to drink beer in Miesbach. It's a coaster for under a glass. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a Brauhaus. Well, some of these, Wikis or something like that, Brauhaus, beer. Tavern.
That's a favorite place at the time? You're
I suppose it did. This time. We were out on the edge of town in Miesbach. We had to go into town.
And some, and you just picked this up to save it?
I just had it. I don't know why I saved it. It just it went in that book and stayed there. It'd be fun to go back to Miesbach and see if anybody remembers that place.
You've never been back?
Never.
When you get together in reunions, when you get together with your friends for reunions,
yeah,
I think, did we mention that before? Did we talk about that a little bit before
I'm not sure
on tape?
Did.
Or was
remember.
That off tape?
I can't remember.
Reunions, what do reunions mean for you? Reunions. Reunions with your friends and keeping in touch with all your friends here.
Okay. Bill.
Letters.
Bill lives in Bulls Gap, Tennessee. And we have been by Bulls Gap. And he has been by. He has been by at Hayward. He has been by here. He went to see us in Tijeras, New Mexico. When the Ranger Battalion had their big annual convention in Minneapolis, he came up with Ima. And the four of us threw together quite a bit.
What year was that?
And they came down. It was after we were here, so it's fairly recent. Must have been 3 or 4 years ago.
And what was it like? What was the atmosphere like?
It's like it is always with those guys. You get a collection of those guys together, all old Ranger Battalions. Now, do you know about the Ranger Battalion? There was the first, and it started, and there were 5,000 volunteers, and they cut it down to 500. And then they went and they landed in Africa, and they did all the African things. And then they decided they had to have some more, so they cut the first up and took two companies and left them there, and two companies over here, and two companies over here, and they made this the first, the third, and the fourth. The second was already being formed up in the States. So they had three battalions. And all three battalions landed in Sicily and got all the way through. They're the ones that put Patton over. Mm-hmm. And then from there they went, what's that first? The first landing in Italy.
Was it Anzio?
What?
Anzio?
Anzio was the second one.
Oh, the second
one. The second one. They landed in Anzio to get the guys that are in the first one out of a trap. But then they landed. All three battalions landed at the first one. Come on, give me a name, you dumb clown. And then they pulled all three of them out, and they went to three alone now at Anzio. And when they were at Anzio, the Germans were up in here, or stopping them to go to Rome, and they went in this direction, and they were going up a dry riverbed called Mussolini Canal, and at night, and they could hear German troops moving across the other side of this riverbed, and they just kept going up, and they finally got all three battalions captured. And one of the companies of one of the battalions was captured intact. And the Germans marched them down a road and put them right in front and said, "You guys surrender." We were fighting like mad before that. "You guys surrender. You give up right now or we're going to take these guys one at a time and kill them." And they did. They took two. And then they gave up. And they said, "Okay, fine." And they put the whole bunch of them on trains and took them up to Rome and marched them around the Colosseum and took films. And this is their newsreel, the German newsreel. "Here, who captured these Rangers? These are all Rangers." And they told the German population what Rangers were, and they didn't say it very nice. "We were released from prisons. We were murderers and all kinds of things. And this is what we were. But we were, and this is what the German people thought we were." Well, and then they took them up into Germany, and they put them in a variety of prisons up in Germany. And I've got stories written by some of them One of them escaped from a prison up in Poland three times. And the third time, he got captured back by the British and got sent home. But so that ended the three battalions. Those that were not captured, they got back out of there, they put them in the 10th Armored right then, and then they took them up, and then they landed in Nice, France, and went up into Switzerland through France. And in the meantime, they had started the 2nd Battalion in Tennessee. And as soon as they got them all cranked up and had the proper numbers, and they had a whole bunch of those they had to get rid of too. And they moved them down to Florida to start training them for beaches, and immediately started the 5th at the same camp, at the same place, and did the same thing. And they all, when they got the 5th ready, they shipped them all, 2nd and 5th, both up to New Jersey, and put them on a boat and took them over to England and got some more training for on beaches. And this guy, they both do. Well, this picture, and this is Ace Carter right here. Yeah, they're getting on the boat on the D-Day.
We're looking at the cover of the book called Reflections of Courage on D-Day and the Days That Follow, a personal account of Ranger Ace Parker.
Yeah. Yeah, and they give his real name. It's not
Charlie. We decided, yeah. Wasn't it Charlie?
Charles, yeah.
You know, this loading at the port in England. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I should know Aces. I don't know it. Here's
DeForest.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about this program? This is kind of changing the subject, but
oh.
Charlie's Follies, the 9th of July, 1945, at 2,000 hours in Markgräfing, Germany. It's a mimeographed program of what looks like a show. Were you in this, Harry?
What it is, it's Charlie, C Company.
Oh, Charlie.
Okay. I had to put on a program this week. Next week, D Company puts one on. Each one, A and B Company, have already gotten theirs done already. But this is the program we have. Like, for instance, Doc Haney, with our platoon corpsman, had the ability to do the directing and producing, the music director, that kind of guy. Kassens by Adolf, well, okay, German. Yeah. Captain Jack Snyder, he's our company commander. The jam band, we had certain guys that could play instruments. And this is what they called themselves, the jam band. Calabresi was an Irishman who had a great tenor voice. He was a squad leader in the 1st platoon.
Were you in the show?
What?
Were you in the show?
No.
You just went to see it?
Well, I was one of the chorus.
Oh.
No.
Yeah, it said dancers.
Was
that, you had dancers.
The girls? Were you one of the girls?
Yeah. Yeah.
It says 30 beautiful girls and something like 28 costumes?
Yeah.
One of them 6'6". Yeah, Mills and Wood. Harmonica and guitar. Yeah. Oh, Mills is good on harmonica. Uh-huh. But anyway, we put on this program. All guys. Everybody in C Company. You know.
And how many attended this show?
The rest of the battalion. All the other ones. So next week when D Company did it, while we were in the audience. And some guy in battalion headquarters did all of this kind of crap. You know. But that was us.
Had a couple of questions. I know you have to
go.
Ann wanted to do something later on, or pretty soon, I should say. Your generation has been called the greatest generation. Your generation has been called the greatest generation, and we're using that title for our exhibition. What do you think about, do you feel that your generation is the greatest? What do you think about that term?
The same kind of people that are here, that are Rangers, are alive today, is still going. It's not changed. We're all the same. It's just that certain people come up to the top and then they override. We're going to be this, like the 60s. You know? Well, these kind of guys were around in the 60s. Except that they didn't, you know. These were this because of the war. They, if there had been no war, they would have just been citizens around town. Like this guy was a cop in Indiana. He became a sheriff of Indiana. Oh, you got to read this story. When he captured that thing, I said, here's his troop. They're marching now to get on boats to go to D-Day. That's him right there.
We're looking at a book called The Fool Lieutenant, A Personal Account of D-Day and World War II. And this is the Fool Lieutenant you're talking about.
Yeah, that's him. And this guy right here, that's Colonel Rudder. Colonel Rudder, he's the guy in charge of the 2nd Ranger Battalion. And this guy is named Edlin, E-D-L-I-N.
So what you're saying is, had it not been for the war and the depression and things like that, you feel that any generation could have gone through that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In fact, they did in the Civil War. There were people just like us in the Civil War. And there were in World War II, World War I. And there are now.
Rising to meet the challenges.
Yeah. The thing about it is, they call us the greatest generation because that clown that was the anchor at NBC wanted to sell a book with the title The Greatest Generation. So we're the greatest generation. Okay, fine. Junk it. No. We're not great. We are just what we are. And if people don't like what they are, or they get out of the way. Now, you see, that's... I have one of those on my jacket right now. I wear it, that Ranger. That's what we had all the way through Europe. The scroll that we could see us wear, that came in July. And they were made by a group of nuns in Europe.
And you said...
But the 1st Ranger Battalion there, that was written. That's where we got the scroll. The scroll is from them. Yeah, but that blue and gold thing, I can show you one. I'll get my jacket out and I'll show you that Ranger thing.
This is a jacket that you wore during the time.
Yeah. Well, no, it's newer than that. That I wore in those times.
Oh, you just put your Ranger patch on there.
Yeah, I found a green jacket that's as close as I could get it. And I put this on it.
And you wear that sometimes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
To reunions?
I'm going grocery shopping.
Uh-huh.
And you still have all your medals and so on.
They're all in there. Yeah.
What are you passionate about today?
I am passionate. I will never, ever vote for a Democrat. I do not like them. They have only one thing in common. Let me show you. I wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper. Here it is, right here on top. Haul up the gangway, I'm aboard.
And the gangway is about?
That's it, haul up the gangway, I'm aboard. We have all our freedoms, we got them. I don't care if anybody else has got them. You haven't got them, it's tough box, go away. Don't bother me. See, I'm not going to help you. See, that's not the way I was raised. My mother raised me that if somebody in our neighborhood got in trouble, we were going to help mom, damn it. So, all right, the people living in Iraq were living in a condition that I would not tolerate myself. I'd have been dead long ago if I'd have been an Iraqi. I wouldn't put up with it. But I don't want them to have to put up with it either, I'll tell you. That's what I'm passionate about. And the Democrats, you can have.
So you're passionate about seeing a need and doing something about it?
Yeah.
Wherever that need is.
Yeah. instead of sitting back and saying, oh, no, I'm not, it's going to hurt me. Oh, well, it sort of hurts you. Big deal. I think in here I'd say it too, someplace. It seems that our lot is that we live with freedom's opportunities. For all of those living under oppressed conditions, that is a tough bounce. In the Army, we used to say tough shit. We are not going to spend anything to relieve the stress on you. Nothing. You have it. You have to live with it. In the Navy, we had a saying, haul up the gangway, I'm aboard. This is exactly what I hear those peaceniks saying today. I close this with a TS, tough shit, an expression we used with one another, which may be remembered by a gang of old guys who spent something 50 years ago. Peaceniks, the epitome of selfish. I am only reinforced in how I see the nature of the animal we are. And I did.
So what you saw during the 60s is not something... All the protests, and what were you thinking about at that time? Did you have the same opinion then as you do now?
Yes. About what I was thinking about then. Okay, I got a 7th grade class meeting tomorrow. What am I going to teach them? Here's my passion now, and it's very quiet. It lies underneath. But I did send this as a letter to the newspaper.
Was it published?
Oh, yeah.
Which paper?
Northfield News.
What? How long ago?
I don't know. It was right after a meeting down on Bridge Square about peace. That's about 3 years ago.
You attended that meeting?
No.
You heard about it and you thought you'd...
It's in the paper.
You'd write something about it.
Did you get any rebuttals?
No, it was very quiet. In fact, the whole thing got quiet. It's as if people read it and knew what I was talking about. And I see it. I saw it in the paper yesterday morning, and I thought, oh, good God.
What's that? What did you see?
This peacenik. We're not going to spend anything. It's costing us. Okay.
And we're talking.
And they can't understand why these guys... who are in Iraq and are taking a beating and getting shot and beat up. Why are they going back for second dose? God, I wouldn't want them to send me home. I don't want a second dose. I wanted one continuous dose. No, I'm passionate on that.
Is this something you guys talk about when you have reunions and think what's going on?
Never comes up.
Conflicts today?
You're absolutely with the wrong bunch of people. All of us agree on that kind of stuff. At the end of it, we don't have to talk about it. It's ours. Mm. Not necessary to talk. No, the things we get together, for instance, we get together once a month in Minneapolis, breakfast, coffee, whatever. And we find out where the best fishing is in Minnesota and where we're going to go hunting. And all of a sudden, we're sitting there wondering, what the hell was a K-Rising? Not that blue K-Rising like that. It was a breakfast bun. Oh, yeah, that little can had cheese with bits of bacon in it. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Where do you meet?
That's our war.
When you guys get together, where and when do you meet?
It's a Perkins on... Lindale.
And 84th?
That's the one.
And do you meet the first Saturday morning of the month?
At 9 o'clock.
I'm coming. I'm coming to the next one.
All right. Anne will be there. We're going to see for
Doug you. Becky. You know Doug, don't you?
When you sit down at that table, there will be somebody sitting at that table that was on every landing in Europe. Oh, every landing will be there.
Should I come too? Can we both come?
Certainly.
Oh, that'd be marvelous.
It's not open. It's open, period. Anne comes. Anne is there more often than not.
Good.
Mm-hmm. There is a lady who was once married to a guy whose father was one of the Rangers. And she has taken over, and she is our guardian angel, and she takes care of us. If we need something, she helps. She is.
It's neat.
She looks after us.
Neat.
And of course, Anne looks after me.
And is this the group that Don Fredericks is a part of, or is it
Don Fredericks is a part of this
yep,
group?
Yep, that's the group I'm looking for. Yeah. I'm interested in their stories.
You know
no, I haven't met him yet, but Doug says that he trained at Auchnacarry in Scotland, which is my family.
He very seldom misses. He's there all. I've only known now for years now. I've only known one that he missed. Yeah. Don Fredericks was the original first, and from Ireland. And another one is, Zane Shippey. Was the original first from...
That's right. Mm-hmm. Hanky, he got off the boat with Hanky, right?
With who?
And going to Ireland?
I think so.
Well, all right, they went over on the... the Red Bull Division.
Yeah, I read that part of Frederick's... Yeah. First American's over.
But he's there, and his wife is dead, but one of his daughters might be with him.
It's a lot of the family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll throw those. They'll put the tables across, and we'll throw the whole thing up.
Is there room for us to come?
They make room.
And this has been going on how long?
Pardon?
How long have you been meeting? How many years again?
Well, I don't know. They were meeting well before I came down here from... But it's for 8 years that we've been down from Hayward.
Wow.
There's a much smaller group of us, Zane Shippey, and we meet on the third Saturday of the month here in Northfield at the Perkins.
How do you feel if you can't go? How do you feel if you miss one, if you're sick?
Well, I feel bad. I missed the last one because of the snow.
Oh, right.
We weren't driving up on a day like that. No, we make it. We'll make it.
I'm looking forward to that now.
Okay. 84th and Lindale Perkins.
Okay.
And you'll be able to find us because we wear hats with badges on them. I'll show them to you before you leave. They're up there.
Okay.
But they have the scroll on. And Zane has always got a black baseball cap, First Rangers on it.
And what is that?
Some of us wear berets. Okay. I've got one of each.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That'd be good. Is there anything else you want to add?
No. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us, Harry, that we haven't covered?
I can't think of a thing. I think you unloaded me when you did the Best Generation thing.
It was good.
And that thing that followed it about what are you passionate about?
Oh, it's good. That's good. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For sharing your stories and your time. We really enjoyed speaking with you.
I don't know whether you not agree with me about what I'm passionate about, but it gets to me. Here, look what I got for you. There. You probably don't want to read it, but there is a story, a fiction, about German soldier and American soldier.
Well, if it's as good as the Korea
the
book...
The title of it is Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I finished your book, you know, the one day in Korea.
The fiction.
Yeah.
And she passed it on to me, and I have to read it.
To me, it read like a script for a play, and I think you should write it as a play.
Which one is that?
The One Day in Korea.
Oh. You know, I sent to the bookstore for those, and I've gotten a second one of Dear Albert... But the second one for that hasn't come yet.
Okay.
But it's available.
Yeah, I have to read it.
Yeah,
please.
I do. Yeah, it starts one morning and finishes one morning later. It is one day.
And it's gripping stuff.
Okay.